So, Francis, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Hopefully you can hear me okay. So on this title slide, you can see the strip in Las Vegas, and UNLV is about a half a mile towards the bottom from the MGM Grand, the big green casino. So today I wanted to talk about the cancer risk. So it's a big problem, the space radiation problem. This slide, too, just tells you that this is funded by the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and my two postdocs, Murad and Ellie Donna, are helping me with some of the calculations. So I wanted to focus on the cancer risk, but I'll mention a few things about the other ones. And the main theme of my talk is to try to give you, what's the current estimates of the cancer risk, and that we're really looking under the lamppost. So we can make estimates, but there's enormous scientific questions that are not being addressed by NASA, and they're kind of falling off. So we can continue to look under the lamppost, if you know the expression, but we could be surprised by things that would change the estimates up or down by a lot that we can't really estimate today. Okay, so slide three, this is the approach we started at JSC when I was there, that you have a major challenge. It can be that we're estimating correctly, or we could be estimating high or low. So we use a form of probabilistic risk assessment to try to attack this problem. We use hypothesis-driven and ground-based research, because you can't really learn too much from the astronauts, a little bit, and then these becomes the foundation for medical policy limits and flight rules. So the next slide on four just tells you the risk. So there's acute radiation syndromes, cancer, cataracts, central nervous system effects, and circulatory diseases. There's also what's called normal tissue effects. That's one of the things that's nice about having a cancer risk limit. If you went above the cancer risk limit, then you'd be at exposure levels where other effects would come in. So you're kind of protecting yourself from other things by limiting how much cancer risk you have. So the pictures on slide four just show you the historical data we published, that you do see cataracts that you can definitely associate with space radiation exposure to past NASA astronauts. So this is really surprising, because it's coming at about 20 times lower than where you would expect radiation cataracts. So it just shows you how wrong you can be. So there's a few papers we did on that that's already published. So the main problem is the type of radiation. So that's what I'm going to focus. There's some background information about the environment and shielding. All that stuff's known, so it's really an engineering problem. So there's no really major research questions about the space environment or the space radiation shielding approaches. There's reports in the 60s that had hydrogen as the best shielding for high energy radiation, and that still holds true, but make a zero or very small exposure, you'd have to have a couple meters of shielding, so you're stuck with a pretty high exposure. And if you pick the wrong material, you can have secondary radiation. But all this is known, but a lot of the secondary radiation is produced inside the astronaut's body, so there's no way around it. Okay, so the slide five just gives you the requirements, where they come from at NASA. I want to talk a few minutes about that. So the NCRP is the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements, and they're chartered by Congress to give federal agencies guidance on limits. And so we have, you justify the risk, you limit the risk, and then you practice a LARA. And our risk limits for cancer are based on a 3% probability. And this was based on a 1989 comparison of astronaut risks to the safe, less safe, and unsafe industries. And then something that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that goes beyond that, is that because of the uncertainty in the types of radiation, which is a major theme for this talk today, we also look at the 95% confidence interval, which means we have to have an approach to estimate uncertainties and come up with statistical estimates of how, the standard deviations and confidence intervals in our predictions. So I'll talk a lot about that. So the limits set your requirements: how long can an astronaut fly, how many times, shielding requirements, dosimetry, et cetera. Okay, so just a little bit about the mortality limit. And I bring this up because in 2013, there was an effort to try to waive the limits. And there's a, if you're interested, there's an Institute of Medicine from the Academy of Sciences report that responds to that. So I think that there's a lot of split opinions within NASA. The medical people, medical policy people want limits. They, you know, they come from OSHA and just the ethics. There's a legal aspect of it, but other people would just like to waive the limit and think about it in a different way. So the, historically, why 3%? So this was the comparison of safe, less safe, and unsafe industries, and the NCRP said go with the something that's similar to the less safe industries because the other risks from spaceflight are could be high, so you don't want to put people in double jeopardy of having everything unsafe. Now, that's 1980s, so if you look at the next chart, 7, you can see these numbers are very positive. There's a very strong downward trend, so there's about a threefold reduction in the probability that you would be die within your, from an accident within your occupation. So this shows for the safe industries like government, so it was 0.36% over your lifetime if you had a 45-year career. In 1987, now it's less than 0.1%. And then if you look at agriculture, that's considered a less safe industry. It was 2.2% in 1987. Now it's 1.1. So the trend is everyone's gotten better. So this 3% comparison, if they redid it today, would be lower. They, it might be around a 1% limit, but there's a more recent NCRP report saying based on the justification of what you're doing, that to stay with the 3%. So the different ways to look at it, so the other one is the flight risk of the launch and the life support system and return. That's estimated now by as 1 in 270. So keep in mind the radiation limit is 1 in 33. The life loss is the real difference. Some, you'll hear some people say that you, your normal lifespan's 80, and if I die of a radiation cancer, I'll die at 78. So why worry about it? But that's not true. That's false. And then the ASAP said if you invest, you can make that 1 in 750. So the real thing is these are sudden deaths, and what's the life loss from a radiation cancer? So we have information from human studies, and it's about 15 years if you're exposed at age 40 for gamma rays. And then the main thing is the different type of radiation, but in space, and from all we know from animal experiments, it would be more. We don't, we really don't know how much more. Maybe 20 years would be a reasonable estimate. So that's really what you're talking about, is that you're going to put someone in jeopardy of losing 15 to 20 years of their life. So how you scale that to a sudden loss of life is the question. So is the 1 in 33 comparable to the 1 in 270? The other part is that one has the a bigger aspect of human error. Most of the flight tragedies have involved human error. So there's different ways to look at it. There's the ethics of it. You believe in euthanasia. What's the risk to firemen or Iraqi war zone soldiers? And that's only about 0.5%. So the 1 in 33 seems reasonable, and it's been looked at a few times. And I think that's what the medical people would like to stay with. They don't really want to waive that limit. And then my note at the bottom is that the leadership would be to find the solution to get under that 3% and not just waive it because you don't want to invest the time or money to find the solution. Okay, so the next chart, 9, shows you some comparisons of what's the average life loss for radiation death. So these are conditional probabilities. If you follow that, if you would die from a radiation cancer, how much life loss? So you have a fairly low probability, like 1 or 2%, if you spent 18 months on the space station, but if your condition was that you went on to have a radiation cancer fatality, how much life loss would you have? And you can see leukemia is always the highest. That's the one, the type of cancer that has the shortest latency. And then you have a hodgepodge of other numbers. At the bottom, you see cardiovascular disease and ischemic heart disease. This is more controversial, whether radiation causes this at these lower doses, and the life loss is estimated to a bit less than 10 years, about 9 years. And the orange one is the females, obviously, and the blue chart tables for the males. So you can see that's what we're into, but these are gamma ray estimates. The other thing about these numbers is that the cancer risk is a stochastic risk. So this means that it doesn't really matter what the dose level is. The average life loss would be about the same, which is different than things like acute radiation risk, where you have the severity of the effect gets more as you go up in dose. So cancer risk, the theory is it's stochastic, and part of that stochastic theory is that the life loss would be the same no matter what the dose is.
So Dr. Kuchinada, this is Laura Bailey. I don't know if you're taking questions in the middle of the presentation or if we're supposed to hold till the end.
I think Dan said it was fine.
To talk through, okay. So I was wondering, was the statement on the previous chart, which talked about a 1 in 33 radiation limit, is the 1 in 33 the lock associated with radiation? Is that what you were saying, and is it related to this data right here?
So the 1 in 33, that's our limit that we use at NASA. That's the 3% limit corresponds to 1 in 33. So NASA would allow an astronaut to have a 1 in 100 or 1 in 50 risk of radiation cancer death, but they won't allow less than 1 in 33, like 1 in 25, for example. And they're not supposed to allow that risk.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So there's the other thing is the type of radiation. That's what the focus is. How do we make an estimate, even though the type of radiation in space is different than what's on Earth? So the background here is we have data from the atomic bomb survivors, and that's a key part of how we estimate risk. There's also lots of medical studies. There's very interesting studies since in the early 20th century where people were using radiation for things like ringworm and monitoring or scanning people. They were injecting radioisotopes that have like permanent alpha emission for the rest of your life. So there's a lot of epidemiology on those. So you have a feel for what happens with certain types of radiation, but not the cosmic rays. So the research focus is how do you take information from experimental models where you can expose mice or cells or other small animals to simulated cosmic rays and then use the human data for gamma rays, mostly a little bit of X-rays, a little bit of alpha emitters to make a risk estimate. So that's the main scientific challenge. Okay, so we developed a new model. This is on chart 11. That's called the NSCR 2012 version. This was reviewed by the Academy of Sciences, so that they reviewed a draft model that we called NSCR 2010. And then they made suggestions and recommendations, and we updated it. So we have a way to estimate the 95% confidence level in our predictions for a space station, Mars, lunar, et cetera. And part of that is having what's called a PDF, a probability distribution function for every factor that enters into your risk estimate. So you have a probability distribution for how well you estimate the environment, the dose, the quality factor, and that's how we scale from the particles in space to the human data with gamma rays. What's the effect of dose rate? So the atomic bomb survivors and also most of the medical patient data is for an acute exposure within seconds or minutes. So how do you go from that exposure to a chronic exposure? So all these things are built into the model. And then we also introduced some of the healthy worker effects. So the main one is the smoking effect, and this is by far the most important, that people that smoke cigarettes have a big risk for lung cancer, but also a lot of other cancers, and also heart disease and pulmonary disease. So if you use the U.S. average population to make your estimate, you're paying a penalty for that. So we introduced some corrections so that we're scaling the astronaut prediction to a population of never smokers, and that was a big correction. It actually lowered the predictions by about 25%. There's some other ones that we would like to include, like your BMI or things like that, but they're really smaller effects, and also the databases to estimate it are more sparse. Okay, so we have models of the environment in the background slides. The Academy said these are very good models of the environment. You know, they have some uncertainty. You can always try to improve them, but they're pretty robust at this point. what you're looking for a trade study at NASA is a statistical model where you can predict what the worst cases were. So we have that for solar minimum and neglected cosmic rays, and also for the solar particle events, what's a reasonable worst case for the solar particle event. Space physicists tend to overestimate and kind of fanaticize what they say. So some examples in the background. One example was Dick Miewoldt published that the 2009 GCR environment was way bigger than what had been seen before. But what he did was he compared 2009 to other solar minimum, so that's when the GCR is the highest, using different methods. And so 2 years later, they went back and they compared the 2009 solar minimum with the ACE CRISX detector using the same methods, and it turns out that's only about 5% more severe than past solar minimum. Same thing with solar particle events. If you heard about the McCracken event in 1859, they tried to estimate this with ice core samples, and there's more recent publications that that's all wet. You can't really estimate it that way, so you're really stuck with just looking at solar particle events since the 1950s, which seem much smaller than these ice core samples. Okay, so this next chart, chart 13, just shows you, you know, we can predict fairly well. These are papers in Science, and we've compared the model to the GCR dose rate on the way to Mars and on the surface of Mars. And they're within 10%. If you start looking at the individual components, protons, heavy ions, neutrons, you'll find larger variations, but I think they're pretty reasonable, and there's no big scientific problem there. Okay, so the first thing we did in the new models is change the reference population. So just on chart 14, talk more about the healthy worker effect, and that's the role of smoking, but also that people live longer. So if you go to chart 15, these are the actual data for the astronauts from in 2013, showing you the survival. So this is called Kaplan-Meier survival. Just say, what's the probability you live to a certain age? And on the left, it shows with the effects of the different accidents, the Apollo and the shuttle and a few other occupational accidents. So you can see that's a very dramatic decrease in the younger ages. And then on the right, it shows you censoring those data because that would be not typical of a population you're trying to compare to. So on the right, we show you comparing to the U.S. average males, never smoking males, normal weight males, and then a model of combination. And you can see the astronauts live very long. So this is statistical error at above age 80 about, but it looks like their median lifespan on this chart might be 100. I think when you have the data matures, it'll be more than 80, but probably not 100. So they live very long. That means a lifetime risk from space radiation has to take into account that longer lifespan. And also the models we use to estimate radiation cancer risks include a good fraction of the estimate is scaling to your background risk of cancer. So when you put in the correct background for the astronauts, especially for lung cancer, you get a much lower estimate. So then that's in competition with the astronauts living longer because they don't smoke cigarettes. So if you're not familiar, the lung cancer risk is the biggest risk from radiation. It's about 40% for females and 30% for males. So when you put these corrections for smoking in, it brings them down to about 25% for females and 20% for males. So it was a sizable correction to introduce some of these health or worker effects to lower the estimate. Okay, this just shows you on chart 16, why the astronauts live longer. And it's not because of cancer risk being lower. It's because their circulatory diseases risk are lower. These are the SMR, standard cancer mortality rate, versus the astronauts versus model populations. And you can see they're lower than the U.S. average for cancer, but not significantly. So the confidence interval has to be less than one on the upper confidence interval to be significant, and none of them are significant. But for the circulatory diseases, they are significant. So they're three times 0.33 lower than the U.S. average. And if you look at, compared to a normal weight never smoker, they're lower but not significantly lower. So that's partly just because you don't have enough astronauts to make the comparison, but it looks like it's a really big decrease in the circulatory disease risk. The cancer one is, you can't really say too much. Now, you would think they would be lower than the normal population, so they're not. That could just be statistics, or it could be because there is a big radiation exposure there already. So if you did a population prediction, you would predict that there's a couple cancers and one or two cancer deaths already in the population when they live their lives out because of the size of the total exposure from all the past missions. You wouldn't be able to say who, but you would say that on average you should expect a few cancers. Okay, so the PDFs I mentioned have to do with uncertainty. So what are the uncertainties? That's on page 17. And you can see that these are publications we did in Nature Reviews Cancer, so very high impact projection or review and a journal impact. So the radiation quality factor is the biggest uncertainty by far. And this is the quality factor. And then experimentally, they have something called RBE that you estimate relative biological effectiveness of particles relative to gamma rays. So if you remember, I think last year you had Adam Rusek from Brookhaven talk, and there you do an experiment with an iron particle or a silicon or a proton, and then you compare that to gamma rays, and that's your RBE, and then you use that comparison to go back to the human data. And the second one is the DREF, that's the dose rate modifier. And we used to think that's a second, but I think now the extrapolation from experimental data to humans is the second largest experiment. That's where we're really looking under the lamppost and could have a lot of surprises because of the inaccuracy of the research program to address the issues about human cancer. I'll talk more about that. Then there's things about individual radiation sensitivity. That will be a big deal in the future, but we're kind of limited what we can say about it now. Okay, so a little bit about the types of radiation. So this is the main issue about space radiation, what drives the uncertainty. So we're talking about ionizing radiation, and so that means the particles pass through atoms, and as they pass by, they liberate electrons. So they lose a little bit of energy, and then electrons are liberated, and for a heavy ion, they're liberating thousands of them, so that's breaking all the chemical bonds and DNA and other parts of cells and tissues. So space radiation does it completely different than X-rays and gamma rays. So if you start off saying, well, I want to use the dose of one type of radiation and compare it to the dose of another type of radiation, you're talking about apples and oranges. It's sort of like saying, I took 50 milligrams of aspirin and 50 milligrams of Quaaludes and added them together and predict the effect. It's really that type of thing. They're just doing two different things to biological substances like DNA and cells. So we give you a little bit of flavor. So absorbed dose is something you probably heard about RADs or gray, but we're really talking about at the microscopic level. So that's the theories of microdosimetry or track structure. So the next couple of slides just illustrates that. So protons are low LET, especially high-energy protons in the Van Allen belt or from a solar particle event. And they're similar to X-rays. And this example shows you if I look at a box that's 5 microns by 5 microns by 5 microns cube, and I put one gray, so that's 100 rads of protons into the box, The dots with the different colors just show you the points within the box where an ionization or an excitation of a water molecule that fills up the box was. So it's kind of uniform, but there's some empty space. And then you can see there's 450 protons are needed to make the one gray absorbed dose, the macroscopic dose we're more familiar with in the box. So now I say, well, what if I start averaging across small voxels within the box. So that's if you click on your slide, you can see going next is a dose scale. And you can see now if I average over 20 nanometers, you can see the scale has some regions that are empty, some that are getting in the green. So that's like one gray. So that's near the average. But some regions are getting 10 to the fifth gray. So there's a lot of variability. And then if I start making the volume bigger, 40 nanometers, 80, you see it's going towards the average. So it's averaging out to the macroscopic absorbed dose of 1 gray. So you can see now what's the scale for biological material. It's less than 20 nanometers. So that smallest scale is the important one. And you can see the average doesn't really tell you too much. Okay, the next chart, 20, does the same thing now for high LET. So this is an iron particle like we would see in the cosmic rays. Here, to get 1 gray, you know, the macroscopic average dose in the box, we just need one iron particle. And this shows you the track of that. So the main part, you can't really see how damaging it is, but we'll get to that. And then you see streaks coming off. There are electrons that come off at very high energy. Most of the box is empty, so let's do the same business of averaging over the voxels. Because you see now there's the core where the particle went, that straight line going up and down has the 10 to the fifth gray or higher. So that if that was the DNA or chromosome, it's getting obliterated where it goes. And then you have more empty space than the protons. Okay, and so the averaging. So here, even a very big voxel, 160 nanometer cubic, is still not showing you the average absorbed dose. So you have to go way up in size before the average macroscopic or absorbed dose is indicative. So hopefully that you get a feel that it is a lot different. And then, so this is the physics. It's kind of well understood what happens to humans when they're exposed. What are these differences? What does it lead to when you have these differences in ionization patterns? And that's really the question, because the biology is much more difficult to understand. It's not like an engineering problem where you can test the part. You have to test a model of the part, a mouse or a cell, and then try to predict what happens to a human. Okay, so the DDREF, just to give you a flavor for that, if you look at the atomic bomb data, the National Academy BEER 7 report, they estimate a DDREF of 1.3. So the DDREF is something where you have a prediction and you want to lower the prediction, so you're going to divide by that DDREF. And you can see the dotted curve is their PDF of the DDREF. And you say, well, how did you get a DDREF from the atomic bomb survivors? Because they're just been exposed acutely, and it's a comparison of acute to chronic, or acute to low dose rate. So what they did is they looked at the curve have of the dose response for the atomic bomb survivors have any curvature to it. If it's linear, there's no DDREF, it's one, and if it has some curvature, you'll get a number bigger than one. And they estimate 1.3, but it's really kind of an artificial comparison. So the if you look at mouse experiments, that's that solid curve. You get a better way to look at it because you're looking at an acute exposure with a colony of mice that you bred, and then you split them in two, and you take half the colony and expose them to a chronic or low dose rate exposure, and there you get 2 to 3. So this is a big deal because if it's 3, you're saying that the risk to go to Mars is 3 times lower, or the ratio of 1.3 to 3. So this is a big question. Is it 3 or is it 1.3? So the BEER 7 report said to use 1.5. The NCRP and the International Commission says use 2. If you go back into the 1980s, they said to use 3. So it keeps changing, and the lower it gets, the more NASA's penalized, and you're really kind of obligated to pay attention to what this value is. So that's one way to look at it, but we came up with a new way to look at it. So the quality factor, I won't go too much into this, is also something that different. If you've heard about the quality factor, it's an international standard, comes from the ICRP, and then the NCRP has documents concurring with the ICRP. So what we did was recommend a new quality factor, and it has different dependence on the particle type. We also have a lower quality factor for leukemia. We have enough information to say that's quite different than the solid cancers like lung, stomach, colorectal, et cetera. And then we have the PDF, and this just gives you some background on how you do the Monte Carlo sampling to get the overall PDF. So you're sampling from the PDF for the how well you predict the organ doses, how well you predict the space environment, the DDRAF, the quality factor to come over up with your overall estimate. Okay, so this is using the 2012 model on page 24, just some predictions for the Mars missions and a one-year space station mission and a one-year asteroid rendezvous mission for females 45 years old when they took off and males. And you can see the median would be the indicated by the top of the bar, and then there's the 95% confidence band. So for a lot of these missions, you're already over the 3% even without looking at the uncertainty. And then when you look at the uncertainty, it goes up to, in some cases, 10% or higher. So that's problematic, is those values. The next chart on 25 is, so on 24, the issue is you need to narrow that confidence interval, but you also have a problem with the most likely answer at the top of the bar if it's over 3%. Okay, so the next chart shows you the individual cancers and also a different quantity we haven't mentioned yet called probability of causation. And this gets to the problem that you have about a 20% or 21% background risk of dying of cancer in the U.S. We told you radiation cancer, you lose more life than the background. That's the crux of the problem. For astronauts who are represented as never smokers, it's more like 14%. But the probability of causation says that if you come back from a mission and then get cancer, what was the probability it was due to your radiation exposure? So this would be the bad press for NASA. So these are estimates for 10 years after a Mars mission. If you got certain types of cancer, what's the probability that it was due to your radiation exposure? So you can see for leukemia, you wouldn't get it. So it's very high. It could be more than 80% probability that someone who came back and got leukemia was due to the radiation exposure. Lung, more than 50%, et cetera. So this is a part of the problem is that you think, first you might make the mistake to think that the cancer from radiation is the same as the cancer in the general population. It's not. It's going to occur much earlier in life. And then you might make the mistake saying that I'm going to have cancer anyway, but this shows you that's true, but if certain types of cancer, when you get them, mean that it's very likely it was due to the radiation exposure.
Francis, John Baker, JPL. I'd like to ask a question.
Okay.
Can you associate these particular types of cancer with a particular kind of radiation or a spectrum of radiation?
I think that there's some common mechanisms that prevent too much, but leukemia is kind of stands out. That first, it comes early, so it's the earliest it can come as early as 1 year after exposure. So that would, okay. It looks like the RBE or the quality factor for leukemia is much lower than the solid cancers. So the solid cancers would be more. You would wonder about the high LET radiation more than leukemia. Okay. And then,
leukemia, you think, is more a product of the low solar particles and.
Yeah, there's a lot of information that from gamma rays, X-rays, that it can come very quickly. And then there's information from mouse studies that heavy ions are not very effective in causing leukemia. You know, they're somewhat effective, but what it looks like is that they kill the cells so well that they're not left around to cause leukemia. So
great.
Same
thing with lung cancer?
The lung is different. It looks like they're very effective for lung cancer. All the solid cancers, those type of cancers are much more complicated. They take longer to develop, and there's a key promotional effect. So there's the initiation of the cancer, but also the promotion of the cancer, how quick it will come. So I have some charts on this issue coming up.
Again, Francis, this is Harley. Got a question, and thank you, Dan, for taking on for introducing Francis, and apologies as I arrived late, so this may have already been addressed. In this chart, probability of death, your model incorporates up-to-date treatment of the cancer, correct?
Yes, we use the that's one of the other changes we've made is the if you look at the atomic bomb survivor data, they have one, they call it a registry, with one database of cancer deaths. So it's from death records and one database from incidents. And we went to the incidents database, and we take that data and we go to a modern-day population and convert it to mortality.
And then so that would include modern treatments, not, of course, the treatments of 20 years hence. Another question is, and again, apologies if you touched on this, just came in when you were talking about space station stuff. Has enough time with enough samples passed so that you should start to see the effects of radiation on, I know it's small for space station astronauts, but you should start to see some of the excess deaths from radiation for space station astronauts.
No, hopefully we won't see it, but if you just use these type of models, you won't see it yet. You would see when all the space station astronauts pass on. I think we did a calculation from Mark Geyer once, right? I did. It was like if you had 100 space station astronauts, you would expect a couple cancers. So, but you have to wait.
Pretty tiny.
Have to wait another 20 or 30 years from now.
Huh. We'll get you back on our FISO telecon then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so 26 is we made a more recent update that we're hoping to get implemented at NASA, which looks at the correlation between the quality factor and the de-draft. So without getting into too much details, it looks like cancers that have high de-drafts have high quality factors. And so the high de-draft means that this only has to do with the gamma rays, means they're not effective in causing cancer. So the question is, if you have a high quality factor, is that so the quality factor is a ratio of how powerful the high LET radiation is divided by how powerful the low LET radiation is. So that ratio, is the ratio big because the numerator is big or because the denominator is big? So we found that in standard radiation protection models by the ICRP and the NCRP that they want to use the low chronic dose gamma ray data because that's what they're worried about. But NASA's not really worried about that, and that ratio could be big because the gamma rays are so ineffective. So we came up with a new model that instead looks at high dose rate gamma rays as our reference radiation, and we found that this reduces the risk estimates and the uncertainty in the risk estimates by about a third. So we were being penalized by how the ICRP and the NCRP do it. So they're kind of a generic model for any radiation exposure. And we think that's not what NASA needs to do. They need to go to the acute gamma ray data and scale to that and not worry about chronic gamma rays. You know, people might have heard about that. There's still controversy. If you go to a low dose gamma rays, is there any effect? And that's called the linear no threshold hypothesis. So we don't really care about the linear no threshold hypotheses because it's not what we're exposing the astronauts to. So we switched this new approach to a model that scales the space radiation as much as we know about it to acute gamma ray exposures, and it turns out that lowers the risk and the uncertainty by a lot. So this is the idea that we know the track, what it looks like, how the particle deposits energy microscopically. And we know that our quality factor function parametrically has the contribution from the delta rays. These are the far-reaching electrons, which are just like X-rays or gamma rays in the core. So we introduce a new model where the core doesn't have a dose rate modifier, and then have some pretty good evidence experimentally that that's true. And then the penumbra, the far-reaching delta rays, would have a dose rate modifier. And so we changed the scheme. This is just some evidence that if you look at chronic, this is fractionated over a week or a couple weeks for different types of mouse tumors, that there's really no dose rate effect within the error bars for heavy ions. For the gamma rays, there is. So the chart 29 just shows you that the RB max, that's where you compare to the chronic gamma rays in your denominator. You can see it's all over the place. Some estimates are 84 for glandular reproductive organs in female mice. These are fission neutrons. These are high LT exposure. It's all over the place. And then if you look at the next column, the DDRAF, for those mouse tumors, it's all over the place. So what we're saying is we'll use this last column as how we scale space radiation. So the RB and the quality factor are lower, but we're not dividing by the GDREF at 1.5 in the BIR-7 report or the 2 in the NCRP, ICRP models anymore. So we're being fair about this, but it leads to a better estimate, we think, and we're trying to get that approved at NASA now. Okay, this just shows you how these two things are panning out chart 30. This is a distribution of tumors for different types of mice and different types of tumors, the distribution of RBE for the two models. So RBE against acute gamma rays is lower because acute gamma rays are more effective, and we're being fair about it because we're not going to divide by the DREF anymore. It's going to be built into one term of our quality factor model. Okay, so 31, just you can read that later if you're interested, just to show you how it changes for different types of particles. We have to integrate over all these curves to do an assessment for space radiation. And then the next chart, 32, shows you how the models are changing the predictions for space exploration. So these are one-year GCR exposures at a model of the 2009 deep solar minimum, using the 2012 version and this newer version. So this is the overall PDF, looking at the uncertainty in everything. It's integrating over all the tissues that make up your cancer risk. And you can see the nice shift to lower values in the orange curve relative to that maroon curve for both males and females. Then the bar chart shows you how that looks at the safe days in space. So if you look at the central estimate, that's like ignoring the uncertainties, what your median or average value gives you. It looks not too bad. You want to get up to 1,000 days, but it's not too bad. But then with the uncertainty, it drives it down. But this new approach adds about 120 days that you could spend in deep space. And we think it's a better way to go and scientifically sound. And this just brings in some of the other aspects I'm going to talk about. What about circulatory diseases? So I don't have too much to talk about it. That's more controversial. It's not seen in every study at low dose. What about the types of tumors? So I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Okay, so these are estimates, and if you're interested, there's different publications out there and a couple more coming out later this year with these new model predictions. And then these are the chart 34 shows you the numerical values for the actual risk. So now the 1 year in deep space looks fine at the central value. In some cases, even the uncertainty for the males, it looks fine. So if you go towards solar max or even the center part of the solar cycle from an exposure point of view, you're okay for 1 year for males. And then even for the 2009 environment, if you don't have these other issues of circulatory and types of tumors, the males are fine to go 1 year in deep space, or almost there. So I think these are all in the positive direction, and we'll be releasing more of that. But there's the other thing I want to talk about is in the last like 10 minutes or so is that what we're doing is looking under the lamppost. What are the things we're ignoring when we do this? So I put here four major questions that I want to discuss briefly, maybe a couple in a little detail. So versus the animal data we have is not state of the art. So the NASA has been funding the Hardirian gland study again, which I'm a co-author in one of the publications. So the Hardirian gland is a gland that's behind the eye socket in mice. Humans don't have this eye socket or this gland. So we don't have data for lung, breast, stomach, all the major ones you saw on that earlier chart. And are we going to ever fund these studies? So the question is, do people have mouse models of these types of tumors? And they exist in different strains of mice. There are some studies with one type of radiation, but to do a good study, you need to use about 6 to 8 types of radiation, space radiation, to get dose response models, and NASA has not funded this. So we're looking at things like Hardirian gland tumors and just 1 or 2 types of radiation for lung and colon. Nothing for breast, nothing for stomach, there's a study for liver. Okay, so that's one question. The second one is, are the tumors produced by heavy ions, neutrons, high LET radiation, different than gamma rays? So it appears that they are. The third one is just inverse dose rate effect. That one probably less important. There's a lot of evidence that it occurs at higher doses in space missions, and they're probably not occurring at lower doses. And then the last one is very important, non-targeted effects. So the other issue about this first one is the types of tumors. If you look at the atomic bomb survivors, I'll give the example of liver tumors. So first, liver tumors can be, they're very frequently from a secondary tumor that's metastasized from another tissue. So you can't look at liver mortality. You have to look at liver incidence. And if you look at the background rates of liver tumors in Japan versus the U.S., they're about three times higher because of some issues with hepatitis, alcohol usage, et cetera. So if you break that number down, it's the type of liver tumors. You have to get really fine into the details here. So hepatocellular carcinoma in Japan is much higher than in the U.S. And the other types of liver cancer are about the same in the U.S. as they are in Japan. Now, when you look at the atomic bomb survivors, which type is being increased by radiation? It's the hepatocellular carcinoma, not the other types. So there are some Western studies, and they look like in Western populations that when you expose them to radiation, they're getting the other types. They're not getting the hepatocellular carcinoma. So we have no data like this to look at this. And it's the same. You go through every type of cancer. So there's 5 to 10 major types, stomach, liver, lung, breast, bladder cancer. There's going to be all these details that could change the answer enormously. A lot of them we have no information, and the ones we do have information is very limited, not at the level of detail that you would need to improve your risk estimate. So I kind of honestly feel that they're not going to get that information, and we'll be looking under the lamppost for the next 20 years. Okay, so to go through these, so the experts agree that mice are a reasonable model to estimate quality factors. We know from the human data, this chart 36, which type of cancers we should focus on, but we don't have the data here. The Hardirian gland model that NASA's funding is a model that was developed in the 1970s, and it's a nice model because the cancers can come earlier than the other types. So the idea was that you could fund people 1 year less because you'll see the tumors sooner. So if you have to wait 1,000 days, the grant is very long. If you only have to wait 600 days, like in the Hardirian gland, you can get the information better, but it's not reflective of human cancer. So what it means, we don't know. The chart earlier shows you the RBEs for different types of tumors from the old atomic energy DOE studies with fission neutrons, and you can see the RBE is varying for each type of cancer. So whether the Hardirian gland is representative of all the other ones, that seems not probable. Okay, so then there's a lot of new ways to do this from NCI and NIH on what I call 21st century mouse models that you would need to study this in the right approach. Now, the second one is the type of cancer. So you can say I have an RBE or DDRF for liver cancer, lung cancer, et cetera, but what about the cancer itself? Does it grow quicker? Is it more malignant? So the information we have in a few studies is that they are more malignant. This curve on page 37 shows you the dose response is qualitatively different. And then the bottom chart shows you that the time of appearance is much quicker for the iron particles and versus the gamma rays. And then the bottom pie chart shows you the spectrum of tumors is different for iron particles. So mice are famous for getting thymic lymphoma in the background. And then in this experiment, they use gamma rays and they get a lot of thymic lymphoma. But when they expose with iron particles, they get a much higher rate of mammary tumors. So the type of tumor or the tumor spectrum is different with high LET radiation. So scaling to the atomic bomb survivors, that leads to a question and uncertainty that we really can't estimate what's going on there. Next one on chart 38 is the level of metastases. This is from Bob Ulrich, showing you that the frequency of metastatic liver cancers with the few types of radiation they did, protons about the same as gamma rays. And I'm not showing you, but the background liver cancers are metastasizing about the same rate as the gamma rays, but iron particles and silicon about 3 to 4 times faster. Another limited study with a transgenic mouse that produces colorectal cancer or colon cancers and also intestinal cancer from Alfornase at Georgetown shows that the iron particles are more likely to lead to invasive carcinoma rather than a more mild type of cancer. So these are kind of snapshots that you can throw darts at them. One of the things would be that some of these studies are using too high of a dose, so the target cells, like a stem cell, is getting multiple iron particles, and they'd have a low probability of surviving. But if they did, they'd have a lot of damage, and maybe that's what's leading to the invasive carcinoma. Well, in space, it's going to be a binary thing where a target stem cell, we either get no iron particles or one. They'll never get two in space. So it could be an artifact of using too high of a dose. So these studies would have to be repeated at a lower dose to really know if they're aggressive or not, more aggressive than gamma rays or the background. Inverse dose rate effect, I'll skip that one, but you could see this is something that's true at high doses, but maybe not at low dose. Then non-targeted effect, I'll finish with, this is something that we assume that our response is linear. So like if you have an exposure for 6 months and the exact same exposure for 1 year, you've doubled the risk. But the non-targeted effect says that's not true, that it's a risk that comes on above some dose, and then it's independent of dose. This has to do maybe with promotional effects or bystander effects where damaged cells cause cancer in unirradiated, undamaged cells nearby. An example would be cigarette smoking, that if you smoke 2 packs or 4-pack, your risk is about the same. So if you have this promotional effect from radiation, then you might have a different dose response. So maybe mission length or shielding wouldn't matter at all if this non-targeted effect model is correct. And then also how you would go about countermeasures would be different if it's the dominant mode. And we don't know. So I'll just skip through some data. So this is something we did. If you look at chromosome exchanges, and if you click on chart 41 twice, that blue line is what you would expect. If you have a linear response and you divide by dose, you just have a flat curve. So what we found is that when you get below one particle per cell and replot the data, it's increasing. So that indicates there's a bystander effect, that the damaged cells are causing, in this case, chromosome exchanges in the undamaged cells. And the Hardarian gland experiment shows the same type of thing, that the non-targeted effect on the next few charts is better fit by the non-targeted effect than what's called TE, or linear response on. So I'll skip to chart 45. So this has big implications for the RBE. You get a much higher RBE if the non-target effect model is correct. Both models fit fairly well, but the non-target effect model fits better. Chart 44, the one before that, just shows you the prevalence is a tumor probability at 600 days in these mice. And you can see what's interesting is that if you go down to an x-axis, say at 0.1, some of these heavy ions are causing 10 to 20% tumors, even though you've hit only 1 out of 10 cells. So that kind of another indication that there's a bystander effect in this tumor response of this particular type of mouse. Again, Hardarian glands don't occur in human. There are differences that we know about between this type of tumor and the ones we want to know about: lung, liver, bladder, colon, breast, et cetera. So we don't really know what this means. Okay, so I'll go to conclusions, running out of time. So we have this new version that we've published, a couple pieces of it. We're trying to get it approved at NASA, that looks at the RBE, or the quality factor in the draft, differently, and comes out with a much more robust and a smaller risk reduction. But we have these big questions. So all these things we're doing are using the available data to get the best prediction. But we know that there's lots of questions, lots of lacking data. The data we need is not there. So you see, we're trying to make the most of the data we have and some sound theories, but the data you really want hasn't been funded. These experiments don't exist. Okay, so I won't repeat the question, but the inverse dose rate effect, higher lethality of the particles, non-targeted effects, and then some of the other risks that we're not including in the risk projections are still open questions about heart disease and the CNS risk. I haven't talked about that. That would take another talk. So I'll stop there.
Great. Francis, thank you so much. And again, Dan, thank you for introducing the seminar. Francis, if you have time, can you stay a bit if folks have questions?
Sure.
Do folks have questions?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm Christopher Stelter. I'm from Langley Research Center. And so does this model that you're including, is it when we're on Earth, we have radon and we have ultraviolet radiation, and astronauts are not necessarily exposed to these risks, especially ultraviolet is like a significant risk factor for skin dose. Has any mitigating effects been included in any of these calculations? And a second question is, we talked about the central estimate for REID and then also the confidence interval. Doesn't it make sense to kind of sum over our confidence integral to find one percentage for REID instead of looking at like the central, the central estimate?
Yeah, so the first question, yeah, so UV, the astronauts, if they don't follow safety procedures, they could be exposed to UV, but that's a non-ionizing radiation, so it's not part of what we're looking at. But
it is ionizing at the skin level.
But if they wear their suits and the visors, and
right?
They have
my point, but
it's not part of my talk. So
no. My point was if the lack of exposure to UV, because astronauts aren't outside unexposed, like they are on Earth.
Yeah, but we wouldn't expect any synergism with the ionizing radiation, so we haven't considered it. They have safety procedures. I'm not sure if they.
Never mind. Forget that.
Okay.
And my second point is, if we're talking about the REID, does it make sense to talk about this is our estimate, but our 3% is our limit, but then we have the confidence interval? Does it make sense to kind of sum over our uncertainties? To find a Bayesian estimate of what our cancer estimate is instead of a central estimate. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. There's other ways to do it. That's why the one example I showed, you can look at the one sigma, the 90 or 95%. You can look at the shape of the curve. I had a paper on that recently about there's an issue about the shape. Right now it's a log normal curve, so it's problematic. I think if it was a normal curve, you could ignore the uncertainty. There's an overarching issue
that's right.
You'll never have a zero uncertainty.
Right.
So if you had a normal curve and you still consider the uncertainty, you're kind of penalizing yourself for an artificial reason. So I think the real issue is why is it log normal, and go focus your research to try to get at that and make it normal by getting the outliers dismissed or integrated into the model. So I agree there are other ways to do it, and in the end you don't want to penalize yourself for an uncertainty that is normal or just can't be overcome. You want to focus your research on why is it high, what caused it to be log normal.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Any other questions? Very good. Francis, we had an outstanding number. Is there a question? Okay. Francis, thank you again. Your timing was excellent. We had a large number of folks online, not at all surprising.
Okay.
So thank you. And folks, talk to you all next Wednesday. Take care.
Enjoy. Thank you. Bye-bye.